Good afternoon. I'm impressed at how many people are still hanging out this late in the day, because it's getting to be a long day by this point in time. And from what my understanding is the first thing I need to do is to let you know that I have no disclosures to make, that there are no relationships to disclose. But I do want to tell you the support behind what I've been doing. My work has been supported by the Clinical and Translational Science Institute at the University of Rochester, as well as by NINR with Career Development Awards. So most people are probably already aware of the challenges that we have in recruiting minorities for any type of research. There is a continued distrust of medical research and medical health care that is basically based on past experiences with, for instance, the Tuskegee syphilis study. Essentially, there's a legacy of discrimination in healthcare and in research that has fostered a reluctance to participate in research. There's fear of exploitation and fear that their data and their information will not be protected adequately. But then on the other side, as researchers, we really need to think about the perspective that we know that there are genetic differences across populations, and minorities must be included in our research to prevent future disparities in healthcare and ensure generalizability. People's understanding of genetics really influences whether or not they will choose to take part in genetic research. And their knowledge is really based on what they've experienced. And most of what they've been in contact with is probably the media, things like news reports, documentaries, television, movies like Gattaca, books, different things that they've come across, which really influences what they know about genetics. And that, in turn, will influence whether or not they choose to participate in research. So the purpose of this particular literature review was to determine what is known about how African Americans view genetic research, what things have worked to enroll people in studies, what strategies for recruitment and or for retention, and what things do influence their participation. Now, how I've organized this is by using an ecological perspective, and people may be familiar with the ecological model. And the two main applicable concepts that you think about here is that people's behavior, they have a lot of different behaviors, and they influence a lot of things around them. But then, in turn, the things around their behavior then influences their environment. So they are influenced by their environment, and their environment influences their behaviors. So then we looked at it in terms of levels of influence, using both the individual and interpersonal level as one main level, and then the community, which incorporates policy and law. As far as methods for doing this search, it was really a bit of a challenge because a lot of the information is really embedded in studies that have included genetic data collection. There's very few studies out there that deal with recruitment and retention for genetic studies specifically. So to do this, I had to look at the studies that are out there. I used a variety of search terms, as you can see on the screen there, looked at the abstracts, and then pulled the data I could out of studies that had it embedded, and then used the studies that did report recruitment or retention. I ended up with 21 studies that were retained for this review. So starting specifically, there are a lot of studies out there that looked at people's intention or their willingness to participate in genetic research. And in general, what we found is that there's a positive attitude across the board for genetic research and an expressed willingness to participate, but that really depended a bit on a desire for personal gain or society benefit. Those were really the two main things that they thought about. It became a lot more complex when you got into studies that tested for specific diseases, like the BRCA1 gene, because then all of a sudden there's an individual risk level that people are, that affects whether or not they want their genetic information found out. So, and that's very different from people who are getting general testing that's not specific for disease. At the same time, there were definitely concerns about the data, concerns about it, confidentiality, and concern that it might or might that it might get shared inappropriately and then be used in a dangerous way. Across the studies, there was a consistent pattern of African Americans being less willing to participate. And then unfortunately, again, across the board and most of the studies that I looked at, they did not really report why people chose not to enroll or They did not report retention strategies hardly at all. Most of it was focused on recruitment. So then if we look at perceptions about genetics or genetics research, instead of looking at intentions to participate, there were two really large focus groups that looked at a variety of populations and cross socioeconomic groups. And their findings here, again, suggested that they thought genetic knowledge was important and beneficial and expressed some of the same concerns that I've mentioned, things like health insurance, confidentiality, risks of discrimination. And another piece that came out at this level was a definite recognition of a need for education. They felt that they needed to understand more, that they might be willing to participate if they knew what it was all about. They did not know anything about genetic screening, not even the newborn screening and testing that's been in use for a lot of years. These attitudes toward genetics and genetics research were affected by education levels, race, anxiety about confidentiality, and implications of genetic information. They did have an understanding that genetic identification doesn't give us a cure and it doesn't give us a prevention, but they felt that there was value in being able to be prepared if you found out about genetic disease specifically, that you could then be prepared, possibly prevention in terms of lifestyle behaviors. There was also a feeling that the information was overwhelming from an ethical and moral framework, especially to the person themselves, the individual who was being tested. And then they indicated that there are risks, and they came up with a little different one than we'd seen before, the idea that identification of genetic conditions with a racial or ethnic group could lead to further discrimination for that particular population. Concern that it could be used unethically, and then it also that it could cause a false sense of security, that if you found out about a genetic risk or lack of risk, you might go ahead and have an unhealthy lifestyle behavior, which would then put you at risk in other ways, so that you could have a false sense of security. But then they also noted that it's extremely important for minorities to be involved to ensure that they will benefit from the science as it moves forward. If we then look at more the community level, examination of large surveys and genetic registries is where I was able to go, and there again, there was an overall positive view of genetic testing, although race is still a predictor of willingness to participate. And this was especially the case for women. So African American women especially were less likely to be involved in genetic registries or in genetic testing. They recognized in this case that the information is more similar to like our health information, and that it's sensitive in that manner. And then another concern came up that, again, I hadn't seen before, and this was concerns that the corporations or businesses would benefit from their DNA results, and they as individuals or communities might not. And so there was concern that others would benefit without them benefiting. Another piece that came out in the larger surveys was that people wanted their own information. They wanted to know what the genetic results were. They wanted that information that was really at a personal or individual level. They also wanted compensation. They felt they should be financial remuneration or there should be the genetic information as something that they got in return for being involved in genetic registries or studies. If there was a belief that genetic research would prevent disease or was a determiner of health over behavior and environment, there was more of a willingness to participate. But again, across the board, no matter which level type study I looked at, African American women were less likely to participate or less willing to. And one other type of studies that I was able to find was if you look at the U.S. population samples, specifically the one I looked at was NHANES data, because they've collected DNA for a number of years. And they looked at it, and they found that predictors for non-consent were being female or non-Hispanic black. But interestingly, in 2003, they stopped collecting DNA. And when they did that, the discrepancy for non-Hispanic blacks and female consenting was eliminated, which tells us something about that the DNA collection was having an effect on their willingness to be involved in this study. So when we think about genetics and community, we can't help but be aware of the public policies and laws that have an influence. For instance, the Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act of 2008, which I'm sure most of you are probably aware of, or also known as GINA. Title I takes effect this fall. This prohibits health insurers from discriminating based on genetic information. And then next year, Title II will take effect, which prohibits employers from discriminating in any aspect of employment. So it really remains to be seen how this will play out. Will people feel that they are being protected, and will they truly be protected? And as we use their information in research. What we do know is that GINA does not provide protection from employers recommending testing. It does not apply to life insurance, disability insurance, or long-term care insurance. And it applies only in asymptomatic cases. So once someone develops the genetic disease, GINA no longer has any role in terms of protection. So here are the methods that have been utilized and found to be helpful. If people understand how you will handle and protect their sensitive information and are reassured that you will protect it, they are more likely to participate. And one of the best ways we can do this is to train interviewers about genetic testing. They need to be able to inform the participants. They need to be able to answer questions about how the sample will be stored and how it will be protected and how it will be used. Brochures, mailings, telephone calls specific to targeted populations, that's nothing new. That's something that we've used in research all along. One thing that's been tried is the use of a separate consent, but that may not be helpful. At least this particular study found that it actually worsened their response rate when they separated the consent out from the main consent. So our recruitment challenges, to an extent, depend on the type of study. If the genetic testing is for a specific disease, that is different than if it's for a non-specific disease, or it's non-specific and not related to a specific disease. But there are some commonalities. We know that African women are less willing to participate, that we need to utilize enhancements, whether it be information, whether it be financial. And then in disease-specific studies, they found that genetic education and counseling does seem to improve recruitment. So just a word about the consent process. There's some lessons that we've learned from large studies. We need to provide information. We need to be transparent. Let the participant know how we will protect their information, how we will maintain confidentiality, how we plan to do it, whether we will plan to report back results to them or not, and then decision making for future studies. And what I mean by that is, will the DNA be used for future studies? Will it not be used for future studies? What other plans do we have for it? They need to know that. And then if DNA collection is part of a large study, we can make that optional. It could be optional. We need to provide training for our interviews, which I've already mentioned. We can offer levels of consent, like partial or full, which means participants can select whether or not they want to know the findings, whether or not they will give a blood sample. And some of this is especially the case if you are testing for a treatable disease, then that information is even more crucial to the participant. Whether a cell line can be created, if testing is only for particular aspects, whether it will be used for future studies, whether it will be used by industries. So all of those levels can be put into a consent to give them the choice of how far they want their DNA to go for other people to use. You can trial a consent as separate or part of the main consent. And then it's really important for us as researchers to find out why people refuse to be involved, because then that will inform us for future studies of what we can do differently. So in summary, the recommendations are that it's very similar to many other type of studies, but we must recognize this as an issue and plan accordingly, especially if we're including African-American women in our sampling. We need to have frequent participant contact, which is nothing new. Use a variety of communication methods, stay in contact with our participants, train our recruiters to answer genetic questions. And then back to the ecological perspective or model, we can think of it in a little different way. I know that's got a lot of information on it, but the column on the left is really the steps we can take to encourage recruitment, and then it's divided out into individual, interpersonal, and community. So for instance, we can reinforce the benefits for them of being involved in genetic research. At the individual and interpersonal level, it's disease prevention, reassurance, it might help people in your family, and then the community sees that as a prevention of discrimination. Financial incentives, increased participations, and the community expects that they will be compensated for being involved. We could share our information. They want to know the clinical benefit, the genetic testing results, and then at the community level, medical advance for future generations. Transparency and alleviate common concerns are kind of the same. The confidentiality, they want to know how you're going to maintain that. And then individualized culturally relevant materials will increase enrollment, and it will also increase embracement by the community. So in reality, in the end, what the literature gives us is conflicting reports of why or why not African Americans enrolled in genetic studies. It's unclear what's helpful beyond genetic education, culturally relevant materials, and financial or genetic information incentives. So we still need more work to do to really sort out what would help us in enrolling minorities into genetic research, which is crucial to prevent disparities in genetic research.
Okay. So I think we have a few minutes for questions, and also I would encourage people, there's three chairs here. So if we want to just take...
Here's a list of the references too. Sorry, this is just all the references that were in there. It's like 4 or 5 pages. Yes?
I was just wondering if you did a breakdown of participation by specimen type. So, for example, in the Black Women's Health Study, they were able to get Black women to give saliva, so not blood. And I'm just wondering if that was the difference.
I didn't see anything in the literature that addressed that question, but that's an interesting question, because will it make a difference? And the question was, if you didn't hear it, is it different if people are using like buccal swabs or saliva samples as opposed to blood? And I didn't really come across that in the literature. I don't know if, does anybody else know? Yes, ma'am.
My name is Shanita Hughes-Halbert from the University of Pennsylvania. We've been doing work surrounding barriers and facilitators to African-American participation in cancer genetics research. And just to respond to your question, we have our qualitative data suggests that there might be differences based on the level of invasiveness of the procedure. So people would be more willing to give a saliva sample or a buccal swab compared to having their blood drawn.
Which makes sense probably to most of us. I know the study I'm doing now, I'm using saliva samples because I didn't want to go there in terms of blood samples. Yes?
What about creating awareness of the work that's being done now with genetics, advances with the Human Genome Project and other such as demonstrating that genetics are not simply for disease, I mean, that's a good part of it, but also has to do with history and ancient DNA, for example, and everything from dinosaurs to plants. In other words, to broaden the whole concept of what genetics means.
And I think what you're getting at is that we need to, there's a lot of basic genetic education that needs to happen, because the younger generation is obviously getting more in school than some of us who are older, but at the same time, the information is changing so quickly. There's the medical side, but you're right, there's also the whole history and what genetics tells us for all the different populations. And yeah.
I wonder, kind of conversely, if some of what you were putting up there as examples is to make genetics more personal, actually, put it in context of people's lives, provide, you know, follow-up of results and research findings, et cetera. Mm-hmm. You know, what methods as far as community partnerships, partnering with organizations that support these individuals over long periods of time, people on IRBs, things like that, that might kind of engender community engagement and trust? And kind of to take some of your comments to even a larger level, which was personal, you know, and then community on one side.
And then public policy, law. I mean, genome was the one step, but there's certainly a lot more that needs to happen, absolutely.
Time for one more question.
Yes.
I can tell you've done an extensive literature review, and one word you didn't mention is anonymization, which seems to pose a dilemma, because on the one hand, you mentioned that people would hope for confidentiality. On the other, they're hoping for benefits. And right in the middle of that is the question of anonymization.
Mm-hmm.
Did you see it come across in your review?
It's kind of interesting because people tended to go back to that personal level. They wanted to know their personal risk. So as much as they didn't want anybody to know anything about them, they wanted to know about them, which is an interesting thing, which is what you're talking about, I think. Yeah.
You came across that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.